Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
In 1992, Austin daycare owners Francis and Daniel Keller went to trial for the sexual assault of a 3-year-old girl. Even though the girl recanted at trial, her claims of abuse, a result of intensely suggestive interrogations by her therapist, her mother, and later police investigators. Other children who attended the daycare testified against the couple. The accusations went far beyond sexual abuse. Children forced to use a bone dipped in blood from a jar to paint with it, calling it Satan's arm. Pretending to cut off the children's toes and fingers as they were forced to close their eyes. Letting infants sink to the bottom of the backyard swimming pool, retrieving them, and then baptizing them with blood in the name of Satan. Torturing and killing cats and other animals, the children, they claimed, buried alive with them. Fantastical claims of being flown to Mexico, molested by servicemen there, and flown back in time to be picked up for the day, and accusations of being shot to death and subsequently brought back to life were included in the children's accounts. Parents, too, offered their proof. Some of the children were afraid to have their toenails cut, they said. Some were afraid of ponies. 3 children began mimicking the behavior of cats, their parents said, crawling, hissing, and demanding their food in bowls. These are only a few examples of the claims a jury heard against Francis and Daniel Keller. The Kellers were sentenced to 48 years each. The couple spent 21 years incarcerated before their convictions were overturned in 2013. They'd done nothing at all. Daniel and Fran were casualties of a nationwide phenomenon that was at its peak, one that mirrored the Salem witch trials of the late 17th century in terms of hysteria and paranoia, not to mention baselessness and absurdity, satanic panic. The Kellers weren't the first casualties or the last. Accusations of satanic rituals and activities weren't just ruining lives in the courtroom. They were hindering and, it could be argued, completely botching missing persons, child abuse, and homicide investigations. The 1988 murders of Sally McNally and Shane Stewart remain unsolved in part due to the pervasiveness of satanic panic. Perhaps an effort to make sense of the escalating violent crime rates in virtually every corner of the United States in the 1970s and 1980s, evangelicals and religious fundamentalists began theorizing that satanic cults were responsible for the staggering murder rates and rise in child abuse, neither showing any signs of letting up. Satanism was the perfect villain. The beliefs, rituals, and symbolism were as mysterious as they were offensive to much of the public. Working with police and prosecutors, religious fundamentalists came up with a list of characterizations and traits for investigators to look for in the case of satanic cults. Some, utterly ridiculous but simple, claims that atheists were actually Satanists incognito. Human and animal sacrifices were becoming an epidemic, they'd have you believe, and ritual child abuse at the hands of these usually multi-generational satanic families was happening practically everywhere. Some characterizations seemed custom-made for parental fear and panic, such as, they said, the idea that Halloween was a satanic holiday and that devil worshippers nationwide were chomping at the bit to poison children's candy. Other claims and characterizations went a little deeper into, for the lack of a more appropriate word, insanity, into vast and intricate conspiracy theories. Major corporations like Procter & Gamble were run by Satanists, they said, and the U.S. government run by an Illuminati of Satanists. The Capitol, Washington, D.C., designed and built with satanic symbolism throughout the city. Of course, the game Dungeons & Dragons and the music genre heavy metal, bands like Judas Priest, Ozzy Osbourne, and Iron Maiden, were recruiting tools for Satanism at large, fundamentalists everywhere preached. Bands like the Beatles, they said, used to hide satanic messages. You'd have to play the records backwards to hear it, but these metal bands just came right out and delivered the message clearly and blatantly. The media, too, was happy to feed the fear that citizens seemed so desperate to feel, which isn't necessarily surprising, but it seems unbelievable in hindsight, even absurd, that authorities in countless law enforcement jurisdictions around the country were eating this stuff up too. But they were. In Texas, law enforcement jumped on the hysterical bandwagon. Ector County Sheriff's Office Reserve Deputy Captain Galand Hurst taught a law enforcement course at Odessa College that included a 5-hour segment on Satanism and deviant sexual behavior. Also visiting other colleges across the state to teach his course, Hurst told a reporter in 1985 that he estimated Texas is likely home to around 10,000 Satanists, going on to say that Ector County itself was home to at least 2 satanic cults, while San Angelo, about 130 miles away, was home to at least 1. San Angelo, Texas, the seat of Tom Green County, can be traced back to 1867 when it was set up as a trading post to serve the desires of soldiers stationed at Fort Concho, just across the North Concho River. Drinking holes, gambling dens, and sex workers did well catering to the vices of military men, but less than 20 years after San Angelo was established, Fort Concho was deactivated and deserted, taking with it the cash to keep the town afloat simply by way of the vice industry. Cattle and sheep raisers, though, kept San Angelo going, and eventually, the livestock and agriculture industries there were thriving. The town remained modest, population-wise, at the turn of the 20th century. Upon the discovery of oil and the erection of Goodfellow Air Force Base during World War II in 1940, San Angelo began the transformation from a quaint frontier town to a city. By 1988, the population had grown to nearly 85,000. Sally Ann McNally was born in Bollinger, Texas, on March 26, 1970, to Patricia Ann and Ronald Wayne McNally. Patricia was only 15 when Sally was born. "I married and had Sally when I was very young," Patricia later told the television program Unsolved Mysteries, adding, "So, Sally and I spent a lot of our time growing up together. We were like sisters when she was small." She and Sally's father, Ronald, divorced not long before the child's 2nd birthday, and the split, according to a friend of Sally, caused her to resent her mother, a feeling that would fester and build, eventually coming fully to the surface during her adolescence after she and her mother moved to San Angelo in 1984 when Patricia remarried. "I don't think I ever heard her call her mother, Mother. It was always Pat," Sally's friend, Helen, said. "She was really resentful towards the fact that her dad wasn't around, and she blamed it on Pat a lot." Sally's childhood has been described as painful and troubled, and she acted out, particularly after becoming a teenager, her mother said. Sally became rebellious and began pushing Patricia out of her life. Regardless of the mother and daughter turmoil, Patricia described Sally as kind and loving, a loyal, caring, and helpful friend who loved a lot and sought to be loved back. Sally was on course to join the Navy, her mother said. She was happy, had her life together, and wanted to be a nurse. While attending San Angelo Central High School in the fall of 1987, Sally began dating a boy whose father compared him to Beaver Cleaver, an undeniably lovable, innocent, and do-gooder character from the late 1950s and early 1960s television sitcom Leave It to Beaver. Shane Paul Stewart was born in San Angelo on August 5, 1971, to mother Caroline Gale and father Marshall Wayne Stewart. He spent his entire childhood there. Shane's father called him energetic, always having fun and making sure everyone around him was doing the same. Shane was in the Latin Club at San Angelo Central High and, his father said, had big dreams for the future, plenty of goals to reach. When he and Sally met, the two became inseparable.
It was like the two kids were made for each other,
Shane's father, Marshall, later said. According to Marshall, when Shane began hanging around Sally's group of friends, he began getting into fights, something that was out of character for him. Shane told his father he'd been ganged up on by friends of a guy he was fighting once. His father told him that the event should have taught him a lesson, the point of which was twofold. Number one, don't fight. Number two, always be aware of your surroundings. By January of 1988, just months after the two began dating, Sally, then 17, and Shane, who is 16, moved into an apartment together. In March of that year, Sally phoned the Tom Green County Sheriff's Department and reported that a friend of the couple's had given them a firearm to hold on to, but they no longer wanted it in their possession and requested that an officer be sent out to retrieve it. The weapon had been used in a robbery murder, Sally is reported to have told Sheriff's Deputy Larry Counts. Sally and Shane sought to distance themselves from their circle of friends who engaged in drugs and group sex, Deputy Counts said. The gun Shane and Sally wished to get rid of was retrieved by Deputy Counts, who said that he thought the teenager's story was questionable until the gun's serial number was checked and it turned out to be stolen. Deputy Counts said that the night he picked up the weapon, Shane and Sally expressed fear for their safety. He said that the two described a group, which included the individual who'd given them the gun, whose activities were criminal and secret. The deputy, reading the invisible ink between the lines, it seems, would later refer to this group as a cult. The word itself, of course, implicated Satanism. It's reported that several weeks after turning the stolen weapon over to law enforcement, both Sally and Shane left San Angelo separately, moving out of the apartment they shared. Why or where, though, is never fully explained. It's only alluded to that they did so out of fear for their lives. If the two did leave town in fear, why they left separately, and perhaps even more importantly, why they waited several weeks after turning in the gun to do so, are questions that remain unanswered. Both Shane and Sally's parents were divorced, so the possibility that each simply went to spend required time with their other parents who lived out of town isn't out of the question. Regardless, the two were reunited in San Angelo in early summer. On Monday, July the 4th, 1988, Independence Day, shortly before 9 p.m., Shane was heading out to catch the fireworks with Sally at Lake Nasworthy. He hugged his father just before leaving, his father telling him to be back at 11. At midnight, an hour past Shane's curfew, a fisherman anchored at O.C. Fisher Reservoir, 6 miles from Lake Nasworthy, saw a teenage couple standing together by a car just offshore. The fisherman witnessed a truck approach and an argument occur between the individuals in the vehicle and the teenaged couple. The teenaged girl telling the vehicle's occupants, the fisherman said, that they didn't want to be involved with that anymore. The witness didn't pay any mind to the situation, really, he said, because he thought it was just some kids drinking and partying. He rose his anchor and left, not realizing then that he'd witnessed the last confirmed sighting of Sally McNelly and Shane Stewart alive. Sally McNelly and Shane Stewart were last seen by a fisherman at O.C. Fisher Reservoir, just west of San Angelo, at around midnight, July 4, 1988. On the morning of Tuesday, July 5th, an Army Corps of Engineers park ranger found Shane's vehicle, a copper-colored 1980 Chevy Camaro, abandoned at a location other than where the fishermen saw the couple. Shane's keys were on the dashboard, and fast food wrappers were found in the front seat. Tom Green County Sheriff's Department Lieutenant Lewis Hargraves said there were no signs of a struggle. Law enforcement thought, at that point, that Shane and Sally had eloped. Shane's father, Marshall Stewart, however, knew right away that something was wrong. His son would never have left his beloved Camaro, he protested. Marshall was in a panic. His thoughts centered around an individual, another teenager, who Shane had been having problems with. He'd once told his father that if the two ever crossed paths, something serious, meaning something physical, would go down. Marshall visited Shane's enemy not long after his son went missing and saw signs that he'd been in a fight. He had several scratches on his face. In Marshall's months-long search for his son, including the rough and rugged area surrounding the reservoir and knocks upon countless doors of San Angelo homes, a phone call Shane received continually went through his mind. On July 3rd, the day before the last time he saw his son, at around noon, Marshall answered the phone at their home, and the caller, a man, asked for Shane. He heard Shane say something about money, presumably that he owed the caller, but when he asked his son if there was a problem and if he needed any help, Shane told him that everything was fine, that he had it under control, but wouldn't further elaborate. Sally's friend, Helen, also began recalling a conversation she'd brushed off before as overly dramatic, but in hindsight, with Sally gone, seemed completely relevant. Sally had called her 2 weeks before she disappeared, in June, telling Helen that someone was trying to kill her.
"What did you do?" Helen asked Sally.
She responded,
"Well, I really can't tell you."
Helen talked Sally down from her paranoid state and didn't think any more about it at the time, saying that Sally tended to exaggerate things. After months of searching for Sally and Shane, a discovery was made about 17 miles south of where the couple was last seen, near the South Pool of the Twin Buttes Reservoir. On Friday, November 11, 1988, hunters came upon the skeletal remains of Sally McNelly. Because Sally's remains had been found, Marshall was listening intently to a police scanner for any word on his son. The following Monday, November 14th, he heard a request for a justice of the peace at the Twin Buttes Reservoir as he was driving. Marshall headed straight there. After an intensive search and in close proximity to Sally's remains, more skeletal remains were found. Though deputies first protested that Marshall enter the scene, they let him through when he told them of the promise he'd made his son, that he'd find him.
"It was Shane, dressed exactly like he'd left the house that night. I knelt down beside him and told him that I found him and we would take him home,"
Marshall Stewart later told the television program Unsolved Mysteries. Autopsies showed that both Sally and Shane died as the result of gunshot wounds, each shot in the head with a shotgun. Little more could be told about their deaths from their remains, since skeletons were all that was left. After her mother, Patricia, carefully placed Sally's prom dress in her casket, unable to actually dress her in it, Sally Ann McNally and Shane Paul Stewart were buried side by side at Belvedere Memorial Park. Tom Green County Sheriff's Office investigators didn't have a lot to go on. Shane and Sally had been murdered over 4 months before they were found, their bodies left in the elements, so any forensic evidence that might have been on or near the remains was gone. They thought of the firearm Shane and Sally had turned into them earlier in the year, but no clues could be gleaned from that. The gun was never linked to a crime. Investigators questioned the couple's fellow high school students, as well as college students who were associated with them or their friends, but nothing was jumping out. Marshall Stewart also took it upon himself to investigate his son and Sally's murders. At O.C. Fisher Reservoir, Marshall more or less worked the night shift, though unofficially, keeping watch after park rangers left for the day. He waited night after night to get a glimpse of any activity that seemed out of the ordinary. Marshall documented everything he deemed suspicious, both on paper and on recording, though it isn't clear whether the recordings were audio or video. He turned over his documentation and recordings to police, which included surveillance of vehicles traveling between the areas where Shane and Sally's remains were found and the area they were last seen or where his son's car was found. Sheriff's investigators collected thousands upon thousands of documents that included interrogations and interviews with friends. An undisclosed piece of evidence was found about a year after the discovery of Shane and Sally's skeletal remains. It was linked to the case, it's reported, but never connected to a specific person. Police were baffled. Their only lead a theory that Shane and Sally's killer or killers were local, considering the location they were found, their bodies hidden, presumably, in a way in which ensured they wouldn't be found in a timely manner. In September of 1991, Sally and Shane's story was featured on the television show Unsolved Mysteries, and Satanic Panic became deeply embedded in the case. Talk of cult activity and implications of Satanism had already made it into the narrative of the murders of Shane Stewart and Sally McNally, but when Unsolved Mysteries aired the story in 1991, whatever the two might or might not have been mixed up in was portrayed as full-blown devil worship, ritualistic parties, and black magic practice. Sally's mother, Patricia, told the show that she'd phoned the mother of a friend of Sally's daughter after she caught her attempting to sneak out the window, and the woman told her that they were, quote, mixed up in Satanism and had a, quote, demon in a bottle, end quote, which sounds more like a euphemism for a bottle of liquor than anything else. Unsolved Mysteries, though only featuring one, said that Sally's friends, plural, witnessed her at parties where such activity took place. The only clear example they give is Sally's friend Helen describing a party Sally invited her to, where she said Sally went into a trance, and while Helen is never heard specifically describing the scene of this party, the program displays a reenactment depicting several teenagers in a room where they light candles and turn off the lights to play a Ouija board.
Sally really got to a point to where she thought nobody loves me, Helen said on the show, adding, these people came along and they say, okay, we'll give you that love. We'll give you that companionship you need. You just come with us and do what we ask.
Though Unsolved Mysteries, along with the sheriff's office deputy who appeared, make claims that Shane and Sally's parents, Marshall and Patricia, respectively, discovered that their kids were involved in activities linked to Satanism, no clear proof is offered. In fact, if there is any substance whatsoever to these claims, it's never been brought to light at all. Over 1 million calls inundated Texas Crime Stoppers after the show aired. The Tom Green County Sheriff's Office later said, proof, perhaps, of the pervasiveness of satanic panic in the early 1990s, since it is miles outside the realm of possibility that the murders of Sally McNally and Shane Stewart in the modest-sized city of San Angelo, Texas, could have realistically garnered that much tip activity. It's likely the concentration on satanic cult involvement hindered the investigation of the murders of Sally and Shane. The nearly countless bogus leads that flooded the department after the Unsolved Mysteries episode certainly took away from the case. Technology, though, has so far failed to provide answers too. In 1994, DNA was found on evidence police found near Shane's car, but has never hit a match in CODIS. Sally was exhumed in 2013 and Shane in 2014 for DNA testing with new forensic technological advances. Tom Green County Sheriff's Office Lieutenant Terry Lowe told reporters in 2014 that the department had tracked a person of interest in the case to another country, elaborating no further. In 2016, indicating that investigators had something to go on, the FBI was asked to provide their resources to aid them. Luckily, police working the long cold case no longer believed that satanic cults had anything at all to do with Shane and Sally's murders. They told reporters that the rumors and bad information were based on media sensationalism happening at the time they were killed, based on the phenomenon of satanic panic.
Somebody looked these kids in the eyes and killed them, basically an execution, Lieutenant Lowe said, adding, the bad guy knows we're out there, and he needs to know we're coming, and we're not going to stop.
Lieutenant Lowe pleaded for witnesses to come forward, saying that there are people in San Angelo who know what happened. In each subsequent news report on the case in 2016, law enforcement seemed more and more confident that they were on to something promising. Then, the following year, with the arrest of John Cyrus Gilbreth IV, the investigation took a new turn, and justice for Sally and Shane seemed imminent. In San Angelo, on Sunday, June 11, 2017, Gilbreth, a local, was pulled over in his 2005 Honda sedan by a Tom Green County Sheriff's deputy. The 47-year-old man was suspected of marijuana possession and admitted to the officer that he had two joints. The deputy had probable cause to search the vehicle on discovery of the joints and found much more. A half pound of pot in a grocery bag stuffed in a black backpack, a large plastic bag filled with smaller baggies suggesting intent to sell, a black lockbox with a .38 caliber handgun and ammunition inside, and a camouflage bulletproof vest. It wasn't the man's first brush with the law. He'd been popped and convicted for misdemeanor and felony thefts before, along with delivery of marijuana. Gilbreth was given probation each time. His passenger, a 41-year-old woman, came clean with police, telling them that Gilbreth often went to Austin to get drugs and returned to San Angelo to sell them. She told them of paraphernalia in Gilbreth's house, and Tom Green County Sheriff's Office investigators quickly obtained a warrant specifically naming drug trafficking ledgers Gilbreth's passenger told them he had in the home. The Texas Rangers joined Tom Green County authorities in the search. Whether or not they expected to find what they found is anyone's guess. Handwritten notes about Sally McNally and Shane Stewart were found in a black ledger that was labeled Open Arms. The notes, quote, specific to the offense of murder. The other items taken as evidence, though never expounded upon entirely, were alluded to pertain to Shane and Sally's slayings too, but were not officially acknowledged as such. photocopied notes, a calendar, photographs, 3 audio cassette tapes labeled SS, a lock of hair, a fingernail, and biological material police believed at the time to be blood, though it hasn't been publicly confirmed. Gilbreth pled out for the drug and weapon possession charges and was sent to a federal penitentiary, but he's never been charged with anything relating to the murders of Sally and Shane. What is known about the man is that he was in Shane and Sally's circle of friends and was 17 years old when they were killed. Police also announced upon his arrest that he's been a person of interest in the case since the beginning. Still, it appears that if he is responsible, pieces of the puzzle are missing.
We get one shot to get someone in the courtroom, so we are gathering everything necessary so all parties are held accountable for this horrible act,
Lieutenant Lowe of the Tom Green County Sheriff's Office told a reporter.
The case is a big reason I am still doing what I do. I want to see this come to an end for the family of these 2 kids, he continued.
Sally and Shane's parents, of course, still yearn for answers. Marshall, Shane's father, says he's forgiven the killer or killers, but wishes, quote,
they would get right with themselves, get right with God.
He gave up Shane's Camaro after keeping it for many years. The daily physical reminder of his son became too big a burden on his emotions. Family and friends of Sally gather at her gravesite yearly on her birthday, bringing flowers and honoring her memory. Patricia, Sally's mother, still hangs a stocking every year for her during the holidays, Sally's teddy bear, the Christmas tree topper. If you have any information about the murders of Sally Ann McNelly and Shane Paul Stewart, please contact the Tom Green County Sheriff's Office at 325-655-8111, the FBI at 325-942-8588, or Crime Stoppers at 800-756-3434. The San Angelo Standard Times, the Dallas Morning News, the Tyler Courier Times, Unsolved Mysteries, GoSanAngelo.com, SanAngeloLive.com, Unsolved.com, BigCountryHomepage.com, and the Texas State Historical Association were used as sources for this episode. If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by donating at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. Thanks for listening, y'all.